Guten Tag, alle meine Leute from Arthur Ecke. Heute ich habe Mark Liebman. Ist ein Autor. Well, let me not do this because he speaks German too. So let's welcome Mark. Mark, come on.
Guten Morgen. Anyway, well, that's the end of our German. although I will say that my dad was in the U.S. Air Force, actually started in the United States Army Air Corps. Mm-hmm. And we lived in Germany a lot, which is where I learned to speak German, although I don't use it very often anymore. And it, as I've gotten older, most of the words have faded from memory.
Excellent. But anyway, we had to start it off different today.
Yeah. But it was an interesting childhood. And one that, as I get older, the more I value, not because it was years ago, but because of the times in the 50s and 60s, mm-hmm. I was growing up in Germany. It was very soon after World War II, and there's a lot of things going on, some good, a lot good, some really ugly.
So, yeah. Anyway. My dad's Air Force. I'm an Air Force brat myself from a Strategic Air Command. So, yeah.
My dad was a tech guy, tactical Air Force. He said the one thing he never would do is go join SAC.
Interesting group of folks.
Yes.
LeMay and everybody. So, yeah.
Yeah. I got to meet General LeMay once. Because my dad was working for him. Yeah. It was not a fun conversation because I answered the telephone in our house and LeMay was my dad was literally working directly for him, was his direct report. And it was like 6-7 o'clock in the evening. And I picked up the phone and I said, hello. And then this strange voice at the far end said, is your dad home? Or your father home? Cause LeMay was kind of formal. And I said, yeah, second mistake. And anyway, I'll go get him. And my dad heard about it. He needed to teach me how to answer the telephone properly. And ever since that day, it's always Liebman, may I help you, sir or ma'am? 10 years
old habits die hard.
Yeah.
Yes. Excellent. So let's talk. Tell us about your books. And I know you've got a few. I've got two of them. And we met in Kroger at a book signing that you're doing. Let's talk about yourself and share about
it. Okay. So let me give you a quick bio and then I'll talk about the three genres that I'm writing. So I'm a retired Navy captain, naval aviator, spent time in Vietnam with Fu combat missions and the tank of wars of the 80s and then Desert Shield, Desert Storm, retired in 93 as an 06. Became a business consultant after becoming a corporate pilot for a while, which was a lot of fun, but it was never home. And now in 2015, I retired from the business world because I could now afford, emphasize the word afford, to become a full-time author. Because I tell people if I had to make a living at this, I'd be living in a box under a bridge. But it's a it's a great tax.
We'd all be together. Anyway, we'd all be together. Yes. We'd have nice boxes.
Yeah. So, we'd have the author's row of boxes. Yes. Anyway, so I write in three genres. I have a series called, the way I describe it is a Josh Heyman, series. It's about a young naval officer, starts in Vietnam, ends off the coast of Korea, loosely sort of follows my Navy career. I had a lot of stuff from my family history as well as my career, but it's the books are all fiction. In all the series that I'm going to talk about, including this one, they're all what I call operationally correct. In other words, I don't use things the way they're not supposed to. I mean, I don't have for example, a 9mm pistol shooting somebody at 100 yards. I mean, can you do it? Probably. Anything beyond 25, 50. Yeah, would I know? Only because if I shot at him and missed, it tells them I was there. Right, exactly. That's not good. Anyway.
Well, folks, his books are very, very detailed and very accurate, I will say that.
So they're historically accurate also. So I use history to drive the plots. And I build the plots around major events. Sometimes I'll quote figures that are well-known only to give context. And since they're gone, and I use things that they would likely say, or sometimes I actually quote them. And then the second series... that I'm still producing, and I said still producing the first three books that are out, and it is an Age of Sail series. It's about an American who's in the Continental Navy, which is the predecessor to the United States Navy, and another midshipman in the Royal Navy. They start as mortal enemies. The American captures the Brit. And when they're going back to Brest, where the American would then turn the British officer would be, and the crew would be paroled, they become good friends because they come from very similar backgrounds. And so the series has their careers intertwining. So now that they're back to mortal enemies, it gets closer and closer together. It will eventually end sometime around the War of 1812. The fourth book in the series, Last Battles, which is the fourth in that covers the American Revolution, which a lot of people don't realize, took 8 years plus many months, and didn't end until the fighting really didn't end until 1783. Anyway, so Last Battles will be out sometime, probably end of April, early May. And then I've got more books in that series planned. And then the last one is Counterterrorism. There are three books in the actual series, and then I'll talk about the fourth in a second. Take place this century. Mm-hmm. They're about threats that the U.S. government does not like to talk about. So Flight of the Pawnee, for example, is about a attempted chemical weapon attack on the United States. Al-Qaeda sends somebody to the U.S. to kill 20,000 Americans in one attack. It takes place right here in North Texas. And guess what? He figures out how. Failure to Fire is about shutting down the U.S. air transportation system. Again, Al-Qaeda is the bad guy, or bad guys. And then the third one is called Insidious Dragon. It's about a biological warfare attack by an Asian nation. Everybody would recognize it's the People's Republic of China. But I set the book in 2002, 2003. When I was originally writing it, it was going to take place in 2018, 2019. And I did not want to have to deal with COVID in the book because it just would just made things a whole lot more difficult. So I just basically moved back. Then the last book is sort of a standalone novel, but it's a follow-on to a book from the Josh Heyman series. It's called Red Star of Death. It just came out like 2 weeks ago. What happened was the fourth book in the Josh Heyman series is about POWs who don't come home at the end of Vietnam. They're kept by a drug lord who's masquerading, who's actually in the North Vietnamese Army. And he wants to ransom these six Americans at some date. And they're finally rescued. They're back in the United States. And there are people in the U.S. who want them dead for a variety of reasons. And oh, by the way, one of the POW's wives is a member of the Students for Democratic Society. Now, Travis, you're not old enough to remember SDS.
Yes, I am.
But anyway, SDS in the 60s and 70s was a violent anti-war group. And they had a group called the Action Wing, which actually conducted sabotage attacks, mostly on recruiting centers, but also they attempted to firebomb some fuel depots or fuel facilities on military bases and a bunch of other things. Anyway, so she marries this naval aviator, and then he's shot down and he's captured, declared MIA, and SDS sends her to Cuba to learn how to be an assassin. She ultimately becomes a freelance assassin, earns the moniker the Red Star of Death. So fast forward, I've had probably two dozen, maybe more, emails from readers saying, hey, you ought to write a follow-on to this book. So the follow-on is The Red Star Death. I wrote it. I sat on it for about 2 years. And I finally decided now that I'm doing self-publishing to pop it out. And so what I did is she retires at the end of Forgotten. Because she's wealthy and understanding the risk of being an assassin, she just lives in plain hides in plain sight under an alias and just lives a nice, quiet life. But unfortunately, 9/11 changes things in a lot of ways for a lot of us.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when Red Star Death begins. So those are the books in general. There's a lot of history in each one of them, as you know, from reading them. And again, I tell people I take pride in being operationally which includes tactics as well as systems, accurate and also historically accurate.
Mm-hmm.
So,
they're very interesting books, that I will say, very, very well written also. So why did you write while you're in the Navy? I mean, How did that even, I mean, how'd you?
Yeah, it's a great question.
Mine was an aneurysm.
So what happened was, or well, while you're in the Navy, either active duty or reserve, anything that you publish, period, whether it's for a Navy publication or a, I'll use the word loosely, commercial publication, has to be blessed by the Navy. Now, the military publications like Proceedings and Approach, I'm talking about Navy ones, All Hands, Naval Aviation News, there's a bunch of them. The Navy, the publishers take care of that because they've got somebody they can, you know, get blessed because military funds are used and there's a flag officer who or somebody signs off on them.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go out in the commercial world, it still has to be blessed. And as long as you have a clearance, it's really, it's more difficult. So once you retire, the rules change sort of. And they've gotten looser the older I've gotten or the farther from my retirement date, which is September 1993. So it's gone, it's what, 30 some years.
Yeah.
But I still send the ones in which that are contemporary through the Navy to get blessed. And the reason why is you have a clearance, you've been exposed to certain levels of clearance. You gotta be careful how I talk about this. You want that letter from the government saying it's good, because if you don't, the guys in guns and badges may show up at your front door, and that's an evil process. It's ugly. So
I wrote
the answer to your question is I wrote most of the books, in fact all the books that have been published after I retired. A couple I started while I was still in the Navy, knowing I was going to retire, but I didn't. I didn't attempt to publish them. And by the way, they were terrible. and I can tell you the story how they actually did wind up being published as books, and one of them became an Amazon bestseller. But what happened with them and stuff like that is a story I can, if you're interested, I can tell you.
Right. Yeah.
All right. So here it goes. So I wrote the book that became Moscow Airlift and the Simisher Island incident in the late 80s. And I read them and I wrote them and I said, this is garbage. And because I was a fan of Tom Clancy, there's a whole bunch of authors that I follow or read from that era. And I said, they're good, but they're not good. I gave them to a couple of friends because I was doing a lot of writing for the Naval Institute. And they said, yeah, it's okay, but not, you need to work on it. Okay, fine. So fast forward, I'm working as a consultant. I'm working my ass off traveling. I'm writing white papers. I'm writing proposals. Mm-hmm. I'm writing deliverables for clients. I'm doing some freelance writing, mostly in foreign affairs. And so I sat down in 2006, 2007, and wrote a book called what eventually became Big Mother 40 and Cherubs 2.
I had that.
And I finished it. I sent it to my friend who is long passed away, who was the editor of the Naval Institute's magazine called Proceedings. He also was a senior book editor. He said, Mark, go find a publisher. We're not doing fiction. Here's a list. Took me a year because at that time there was a thing called a recession going on. A small independent press said, I love it. It's two books. And let's split it apart. And I'm going to have you work with an editor. And you're going to have to pay for this, but she's going to take you through a boot camp on how to write a novel. And she did. And I forever in debt to this woman. And out came Big Mother 40, followed very quickly by Cherubs 2. Big Mother 40 became, as a story about Vietnam. It's all about combat search and rescue and special operations. There's a secret missile base in North Vietnam. You get to meet the North Vietnamese base commander, the Russian advisor, who's advising him on how to shoot missiles. So it's pretty involved. Friends of mine will tell you there's more fact than fiction in it. And it's also a primer on how to fly helicopter special operations. But having said that, and the book came out in 2012, instantly became, or within the first 6 months, it became an Amazon bestseller. And the readers who they poll every so often, in fact, they were doing formal surveys at the time, I think they've stopped, rated it as the top 100 novels of its genre, which is war novels.
Oh, wow.
Post-Vietnam. It was number 47. So
impressive.
You know, and I use that. and I got Amazon's permission to use it. Again, I think I'm pretty sure they stopped. But anyway, it was a success. Cherubs 2 came out. It got its title because that was the I spent a lot of time flying around at 200 feet. And as you know, in the Angels are 1,000 feet above. So Angels 4 is 4,000 feet. Cherubs 2 is 200 feet. And so that came out. And when he accepted, get back to how these two bad books that I wrote originally came out. So when the publisher accepted, he said, Mark, he said, I love these things, but you need to write a series. Series that's sell better. I said, well,
sure, yeah.
Okay. And I said, we got two now. He says, yeah, I need at least five. And I went, gulp.
Wow.
So I had these two things sitting in my on my laptop. One was titled Moscow Airlift. The other was titled the
I have that one too.
Oh, you do?
Moscow Airlift, yeah.
And the other one was titled The Curl Wedge Incident. And nobody knows what the curl wedge is. And when I wrote the book, it really didn't deal with what the curl wedge is, which is that area between Hokkaido and Honshu, which the U.S. Navy would use to hide aircraft carriers in a war with Japan. I mean, not Japan, with the Soviet Union. Anyway, so I whipped those out. Okay, so now I got two. And so I had to come up with the other three, which became Render Harmless, Forgotten, Interlook, and then Moscow Airlift, and then the curl wedge became the Simisher Island incident. And those two, by that time, I kind of knew what I was doing. So it was a massive re-edit as opposed to starting from pretty much starting over. But it was a massive re-edit. The curl wedge incident was pretty much rewritten from scratch. I used the same characters, pretty much the same timeline, but it was really written. And one of the things I discovered right in the curl wedge incident, which I had not discovered early on, was that since most of the book was taking place in DC and in the United States, Washington DC or the United States, and in the time zone Japan and the Kuril Islands are in, you got a long time zone, and suddenly I had to deal with events happening in one day at the same time on another day. You know what I mean? And that
mine are like that. Flames of Deception and Cobalt, because some stuff takes place in DC, some stuff takes place in China, some place in Russia. You got all these timelines you're trying to intersect.
Yeah, it's okay when you stay on the same day because it's easy to put them in sequence. And I would always start with the one that was farther east from the US. Mm. But now when you do that when you're dealing with the next day in Japan, it presented an interesting challenge from sequencing the passages. But anyway, so Moscow Airlift is actually pretty popular now. It wasn't when it first came out. And the curl wedge incident, when it came out, became an Amazon bestseller, much to my surprise.
That's always good.
Of the three books, of the seven books in the Josh Heyman series, Big Mother 40, Forgotten, and Simisher Island incident, all became Amazon bestsellers. So now, but I go back to my statement earlier. That means that the box I would be living in under the bridge would be nicer than just a plain cardboard box. I might be able to
afford some more. It'd be a refrigerator box because they're taller.
Yeah. Okay. I'd have a wood frame for it.
Yeah. Excellent. So do you write all the time? Do you have certain times you write? What's kind of your repertoire? Yeah, so
I'm a morning person.
Me too.
So I get up somewhere 6:30-ish, go walk the dogs, go work out. I don't work out every day. I take every fifth day off. And then I sit down at my laptop like I am right now. And I try to write in the morning. When I say write, it's either the creative part or the editing, which is also creative because you're constantly revising stuff. And then typically I'm gassed by one or two. I take a break for lunch. And then I work on what I call administrivia, setting up interviews like you, contacting people about speaking events. I do a fair amount of public speaking, which by the way is pretty lucrative. I work on things like I have a YouTube channel now and some presentations, although that's part of the, quite often that's creative, but also once you get the PowerPoint done, it's not so much writing as it's editing. I'm contacting magazines, you know, are interested in an article on this. Again, I get paid for writing for some publications. It doesn't nearly cover the time. Right. I'm well below minimum wage.
As we all are.
Yeah, but it's a labor of love. So the answer to your question is I write probably 5 or 6 hours a day, probably 6 days a week at least, but sometimes every day.
Yeah, I think it's key that you said that you take a time out to basically market yourself and market your books. That every author has to do that. And you can't do it the day the book is released. You've got to start lining stuff up weeks in, 6 to 8 weeks in advance is probably, pretty good time to start lining everything up from a marketing perspective, whether it's to get on podcast, whether it's to get the ACR copies out to folks and start getting those reviews in. It's critical to do that. Don't wait. I waited till both books, really. Didn't do well at all on marketing it, right? This one, 104, I've done a much, much different, more
proactive. Yeah, you learn something every time. And I tell people, because I do it for VHPA, although we've stopped, but also for Naval Helicopter Association.
Yeah.
Do writers panels to encourage people like me to write books, and air crewmen and maintainers and stuff like this, mm-hmm. to write books about our experiences. And what I tell them, there's three major things that have to be done. One, you got to write the manuscript. That by far and away is the easiest.
Yes.
The next hard one is you don't have a publisher, finding the publisher who will take you on as a first-time author, unless, of course, you want to self-publish. I don't recommend doing that the first time because you learn so much going through a publisher, I'm not going to criticize people who do that. And then the last hard part, which to me is the hardest, is the publicity side.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's a little different.
I like a pie. There are three pieces of a pie, but all those pieces are not equal.
Yeah.
And you dip out the manuscript, that's books done. You're done with the editing, but that third piece of pie, the marketing, you can never finish.
Right.
It's like being in San Antonio in the summer with a huge margarita at the Riverwalk, and the thing never is empty because it's just melting. Right. So you keep on drinking.
It's a really big margarita. You don't care.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's why I kind of.
But you're right. The marketing is a never-ending process. And the other thing I tell authors, everybody is different. Don't expect, mm-hmm. first of all, most publishers, even the big houses, don't do a lot these days in marketing.
Nope.
Helping you market. If you're Stephen King or John Grisham, your name just sells books, but they're one in a million. So the rest mm-hmm. of us, and the other thing I tell people, I says, the average author who self-publishes sells at most 2,500 books. When you get to 10,000 books of any particular kind, mm-hmm. you're now pushing in the top 5 or 10%. Yep. And it's amazing. But anyway, what I tell aspiring authors, you have to figure out what you're really good at. So what mm-hmm. I've kind of gravitated to is public speaking. And I don't talk necessarily about my books. I talk about foreign affairs, aviation history primarily.
Mm-hmm.
I now have a YouTube channel that generates money. So I put a lot of the speeches on YouTube. And to build my brand, that's why I do the freelance writing. The books come out in between. And then the other thing I have is I have a newsletter that I put out every month. I know you
get
it.
Very good, by the way. Yep.
Yeah. Thank you. And I got right around 4,000 names. Every 6 months I purge the names, so I'm now below 4,000, and it builds back up. And then people join. What's interesting is as my YouTube channel has begun to succeed, I'm getting names from that as well. But anyway, you got to do all these things, and that's what I call the administrivia side of it. It has mm-hmm. nothing to do with it has something to do with writing a book, mm-hmm. but it's not. And then here's the other thing. Mm-hmm. I get asked this all the time. Do I ever get writer's block? Answer is all the time. So the next question is, what do you do? Well, first thing I do is I'll use the word pen down. It's actually a computer. And I'll go do something else. And what I find is when I'm working out on the elliptical or the exercise, the recumbent bike I use, I let my mind sort through the problem that's causing the reader's block, a writer's block.
Yeah.
And then I typically come back with my subconscious or conscious, I'll work out a solution. I'll come back, I'll sit down. It isn't always perfect or good, but it gets me going again. And I figure it out. And what people say, well, what causes it? And I tell them, you're going to laugh. I said, I start with an outline. I have a whole process to go through, but anyway, I have an outline and I'm writing the book and the character, because when you're writing a passage, you become the character, particularly if you're doing fiction. And the character has written me, or I've written myself, into a corner. And what the hell do I do? What the hell does he do? So you got to come back, think as the character. And when you're writing Age of Sail, it's much harder because you have to think in terms of somebody living in the 1790s or 1780, and life was a lot different. And you have to think like that character, and then you start to work. You know, what will Jaco Jacinto do, or what will Darren Smythe do, or what will Shoshana Laredo do? So you just you have to think through that, and then and that's how I get through the writer's block. I want to make one other point, though, but I just rocketed through my brain. I also tell people when I'm doing these coaching things is don't be afraid to dig into areas that make you uncomfortable, because you must make your characters interesting. And to do that, they have to be different. They have to have quirks and peccadillos. They have to be believable, but they have to be interesting. So that means in today's world, they can be gay, they can be transgender, they can be disabled, they could be male, female. The world's your oyster in creating these characters, because they didn't just pop up in the 21st century. But now we're much more open about talking about them. So, and that's what I get, the compliments I get a lot about my books is, besides the fact they're historically operationally accurate, there's interesting people in them.
Yeah, I did I normally write thriller fiction, espionage type books, but then I had an idea for a World War I fiction and just stopped in the middle of a book that I was writing. I was 50,000 words into it and stopped and started writing one of four. And what makes it unique is if somebody comes up to me and says, Travis, who is the soldier? You know, I don't know. I don't know what he looks like, because I never thought about that. He's unknown. I don't know where he's from. I don't know his name. I don't know anything about him, but what he does as a soldier and what he did as a leader and an NCO. So I'm thinking to people, oh, it needs to be a movie. I said, if it's a movie, they can never show his face in the movie. You really won't even know who the actor is.
Wow. Yeah, that's an interesting concept.
Because it's a diary of an unknown soldier, and that unknown soldier is buried in Arlington National Cemetery.
Basically. Yeah, no, I get it. The fact that he's unknown and he's effective as a soldier, but you never see him. You don't know where he's from. You don't know how he grew up. You don't know what.
No.
All you know is that in this case, he's a leader and he's effective, but ultimately he dies and he's unknown.
Right. And there's nowhere he's from, or he has a wife and son, but he doesn't tell anybody because he wanted any preferential treatment.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Missions. He wants to be out there and lead. And it's all about his experience from a private up to an NCO, how that World War I affect him as he moved from June 1917 to October 1918, almost in a day-to-day history of it's a diary, basically. And the son reading, Alex, the son reading the diary, him and his dad read the diary and follow his footsteps in France. And the son can see everybody in his mind and when he's reading it, but the unknown soldier. He can never, ever see his face. And when the unknown soldier dreams, he can't see his face. It's interesting.
Very, very interesting. I'd love to read because the twist about having the son follow his father's footsteps in France and post World War One France.
It's a father and son who are estranged on a vacation, present day France, who finds this diary hidden in a Bible in the oldest bookstore in Paris, and don't know until they buy the Bible, and then open it up and boom, and they read it. And it brings them closer together. You can see the bonds of the father-son relationship start melting back together.
Wow.
That's a journey. Cool. It's the journey that that they take. So I've had somebody read it. One of the guys wrote or read the ARC copy. He goes, man, Trav, this is a leadership book. This talks about, you know, because how he works. And I wrote from the aspects of an NCO. That's all I know.
Yeah.
Right? I was an NCO in the Army.
Yeah.
I know about NCO stuff, how you do your men and everything. So it was fun. But what I found out is I love writing historical fiction. So I'm going to write another one because something I read while I was doing this one. And the time it took to research is just, and the things you learn, you're like, and my family got tired of hearing me say, did you know in World War One?
Yeah. So let me tell you something about that. So I like the great thing about historical fiction is you can create what you want, but you get involved with it. So out of the Age of Sail series, I have a blog that comes up every Sunday on the period between roughly 1770 and 1816. And I'm 250 odd of these things into it now. And
wow.
Yeah, it's like, did you know this? But I the other thing I tell people is, even when you're writing historical fiction, my first draft, probably 40 to 50% of my time is spent researching, research, and the rest of the time is writing. Now, when you get into second and third drafts, the research part drops off, but always is something when you're doing the editing. Go, oh shit! I got to go fix that, and you got to go research that.
Right.
I show people when I talk about this is a passage in Render Harmless, which takes place in a hotel in East Germany that's run by the Stasi in 1976. And I had been there as a child. My father had taken us to East Berlin, and this hotel was literally just on the other side of the wall. So on one side, the restaurant at the top of this 20-some story hotel. You can see West Berlin, and then the other side is dark. It's East Berlin. Yeah. And so I remember it took me 5 hours to find photographs of that restaurant from that period. Yeah. So, and also description of the hotel and the room so I could write something about it. And it's, and in the finished published version, it's probably about 50 words, if that.
Yeah. But it takes so long. I didn't know. You know, normally in a lot of the books today, there's a lot of swearing and stuff. But in World War One, they didn't swear; they just weren't part of the vernacular. So you know, there may be 3 S words in the whole book, I think, or maybe right. So you know, the mannerisms and, but yeah, and every trench had an alias, like they called, you know, one trench New York City or the subway. Or whatever, and everybody had nicknames.
Yep,
you know they didn't go by their names.
Yeah, so in writing Age of Sail, I had to learn how I learned vernacular. So you can't, if you wrote in the diction of the 1790s, nobody would read it because they couldn't understand it. So you have to use some words from that thing to give people the flavor, and then you have to use a couple phrases to give people the flavor. So. I literally have dictionary. I have a dictionary of slang from that era, which I had to find in a used bookstore. I have. Wait, hold on a second. Let me reach back here. So for example, the sheriff's picture frame is a slang for a gallows. A pintle house is a whorehouse. Pintle merchant is a whore. Excuse me. So you have to use those kinds of terms. And then you write a few words explaining what the heck it is. So
a glossary in a book as you're reading it.
So I just pull this up. So a brown cow is a barrel of beer. You know, somebody's baked, they're exhausted. So you have to use those kinds of terms to make the beer, to give yourself credibility. And then the other thing is in writing Age of Sail is I'd grown up sailing, you know, single masted sloops, even ketches and yawls, which have a small mast in the back. So I thought I knew about sailing. And I was a fan of Hornblower and Aubrey Martin, and then and Richard Bolt. Anyway, that genre. So I started buying books on how to sail a square rigged ship. And so you get to it, and I wrote a passage on how to tack the ship. It took 5 pages, which is about 250, 300 words a page. That's 1,500 words just to tack a ship. And I read that, and I said, no, I got to skinny this down. Mm-hmm. So in each Age of Sail book, there's one passage where I go to some level of detail, but I go into a level of detail at a different phase of the process. Because if not, the reader will just eyes will roll back in his head. He'll put the book down. I want to keep him turning pages. Yep. So I got to get back to the action. But anyway, so it's really interesting. But let me come back to this. I tell people, writing about the Age of Sail, there's no electricity, which means there's no internet. You can't pick up the phone and call anybody. There's no drugstore or supermarkets or whatever. If you want chicken for dinner, you go out into the chicken coop, capture a chicken, wring its neck, pluck it, cook it, and then you smoke what's left so it doesn't spoil. Okay. If you want to communicate with somebody, you do it via letter. And one of the things that's amazing to me from that era is that Royal Mail before the American Revolution had 3A service from Boston to New York and overnight service from New York to Philadelphia. And that continued through the war and then after the war when Ben Franklin created the U.S. Post Office. And they were running what they call packets up and down the East Coast, carrying mail and newspapers and stuff like that. And
that's interesting.
Again, if you wanted to communicate with somebody in England, you wrote a letter, you posted it. 6 to 8 weeks later, it would get to an English port. And then typically it was 2 or 3 days someplace in England, particularly with London. But if it was Liverpool and it came in Southampton, it could be a week. You had to wait. The person had to write. And then it returns. So you talk about 6 weeks plus, say, 2 weeks at the other end. That's suddenly 14 weeks, which is 3.5 months. And here's the other exciting thing. Is paper was very expensive. So you were very terse and precise in how you wrote.
Right.
Forget the stamp tax and all that kind of good stuff. But it's just fascinating how they lived. And again, when you have to transport yourself back to 1790, if you're writing in that genre, as I am right now. In fact, I'm working on the fifth book in the series. As we speak. In fact, as soon as I hang up from this, I'm going to spend the afternoon working on it.
Yeah, I'm going to start on the second one. I know where the theme, how I want it, where I want it, put it from something I read doing the research for 1 of 4. But yeah, well, Mark, it's been a pleasure. This has been very, very entertaining and very insightful.
Thank you.
You've been writing for a while. You're very successful. And in the writing process, because I was naive. I thought, I'm going to write a book and everybody's going to buy it. That doesn't happen. That doesn't happen. And I don't have a TV show to promote it. Right? Or everybody would buy it. I don't have a TV show.
My first publisher disabused me of the fact that people are going to just flock to Amazon to buy your book. So anyway, I did a few things to promote it. And I do pretty much the same things each time, but it is what it is.
Yeah, but when I go out and say, I'm pimping my book. I'm
And every time you go on vacation, it's research.
Yes, it is. Every time. Going to Europe this summer. Excellent. Yep. Well, Mark, it's been a pleasure. I hope to see you again in Kroger. Need to get a copy of 1 and 4 to you and stuff. So let me know.
Super. Look forward to it.
Excellent.
Thanks much.
All right, Mark.
Bye-bye. Bye.